I'm Marty Moscoe, welcome to Radio Times. Just before airtime this morning, former Vice President Joe Biden pulled ahead of President Trump in Pennsylvania, increasing his chances that he will win the state's coveted 20 electoral college votes in the White House. The final results are not final yet. It is still too close to call. It has been a nail-biting few days in the Commonwealth and in other battleground states where Trump and Biden have fought for every vote. Biden's success has depended on mail-in ballots, while Trump has depended on in-person voters. And while Biden has called for every vote to be counted, President Trump and his campaign team have sent lawyers to states, including Pennsylvania, where he was losing, to stop the vote or challenge the count, and has claimed without evidence that fraud is keeping him from winning a second term. Today on Radio Times, where things stand, what it means, voter turnout, the political mood of the country, and more. And we begin with Holly Otterbein. She's a reporter for Politico covering the 2020 presidential race. And Holly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And I know you can only give us a couple of minutes, so let me just throw a couple of questions at you. Where did these votes come from that put Biden ahead of Trump?
Yeah, it's actually quite a story. The votes came from Philadelphia, which, of course, is the city that Trump has railed against for months. He said bad things happened in Philadelphia at a debate a few months ago, and Philadelphia ended up being the place that helped put Biden into the lead spot in the race in Pennsylvania. There was a batch of about 30,000 mail ballots that Philadelphia counted and reported this morning, and that's what got him over the edge. Now he's about 5,000 votes ahead of Trump.
And what percentage of those mail-ins went for Biden and went what percent for Trump?
I didn't do the breakdown in Philadelphia specifically, but statewide, the breakdown has been about 76% going for Biden, 23% going for Trump. And we knew that we were going to see this disparity because, you know, after Trump's campaign to basically demonize mail voting, me and many of his supporters decided not to vote by mail. That's really not surprising, especially in Pennsylvania, where we don't have a tradition of mail voting. This is the very first year that Pennsylvanians can do no excuse mail voting. And so you didn't have a tradition like other states, and then Trump demonized it. And I think that's what led to many Republicans deciding not to cast their votes by mail.
As you said, Holly, you haven't done the math yet, but do we know how many votes are left to be counted?
So I tried to crunch those numbers. Hold on 1 second.
Putting you on the spot here.
There's still roughly 132,000 mail ballots to be counted statewide. There's also some provisionals. We don't know the exact number. Military ballots, overseas ballots. So there's a little bit more counting to do. We don't know exactly when it's going to be finished.
I've been looking at the Pennsylvania map, which has largely in past years been, you know, blue around Pittsburgh, certainly blue around Philadelphia, and sometimes a light blue around some of the more urban parts of the state. But when I look at it today, I see the eastern part of Pennsylvania is looking kind of bright blue. What does that tell us?
Well, I mean, of course, the southeast is, bastion of Democratic votes, and Biden, you know, according to the numbers that we have now, saw a real surge in the Philadelphia suburbs, which is what he intended to do. He also, you know, had a good performance in northeastern Pennsylvania. This is an ancestrally Democratic area, a white working class. In 2016, Trump was able to flip several counties up there and outperform past Republicans. Biden is from northeast Pennsylvania, from Scranton. And so he did better in Lackawanna County, where Scranton is, than Clinton did. And then he flipped Northampton County. And then he also, in northwestern Pennsylvania, it looks like he flipped Erie. I should say it looks like he flipped Northampton. It's very close. But regardless, he clearly outperformed Clinton in those areas. And that's exactly what his campaign intended to do. The Trump campaign said that it was going to win by, you know, running up the score in pro-Trump areas in places like western Pennsylvania. He actually did do that in many of these counties. You see the numbers go up. But Biden was able to also boost his numbers in some of those areas. And so that's enabled him to, at least at this point, have the lead. And, you know, if the mail ballots continue to trend in the way that they are,
Well, turnout in Pennsylvania and across the country has been just extraordinary. Holly, final question to you. What other, I know you're, you know, we've been talking about Pennsylvania, but there are other states at play. What other states are you looking at?
All eyes are in Georgia. Biden has taken the lead by a very narrow margin there. And so, you know, I think the question is, who's going to report faster? You know, Georgia and Pennsylvania, everyone's watching them.
The race between the two states. Holly Otterbein, yeah. Thank you for getting our conversation started. I know you're a busy girl today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for Politico. Joining us and staying with us for the rest of the hour, Ali Valenzuela. He's an assistant professor of politics affiliated with a program on American Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics, and that's at Princeton University. Ali Valenzuela, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Kelly Dittmar. She's a professor of political science at Rutgers University in Camden, director of research at the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. And Kelly Dittmar, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
And to our listeners, we want to hear from you as the results come in, the nail biting continues. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Ali, let me just get a sort of broad-based response from you as we look back now on what looks like the very few last hours of the 2020 presidential campaign. Are there lessons to be learned from what happened this year?
Well, sure. I think there's probably lots of lessons, but I do think we need to be a bit patient still and wait for the dust to settle. A bunch of votes are still being counted, because of how close it is, I think it's hard to say exactly what those lessons are going to be. I think one that keeps kind of gnawing at me is this idea that a widespread repudiation of Trump and Trumpism is not going to materialize, right? So it looks very much like Trump's going to lose the election. But I think his most vocal enablers and supporters in Congress, in the House, as well as in the Senate, look to be, winning re-election. So, I think in light of his massive failure on handling the pandemic, thousands, hundreds of thousands at this point of dead Americans, an economy that's in shambles, none of it seemed to have much of an impact beyond the presidential race. You know, a little bit on the margins. Colorado, right? The Senate race flipped to Democrats. But a lot of it kind of seemed to continue.
Well, and I'm looking right now, Biden leading in Pennsylvania by almost 7,000 votes. So obviously we're still very close. And no matter what the final results are, it will be a very close race here in Pennsylvania. Kelly, from your perspective,
that's right.
there was a lot of outreach to women across the country. I know we don't have all the final results, but what role do you think women, again, broadly speaking, played in the 2020 elections?
Well, on the voter side of things, we know that women continue to be the most reliable voters, so they outnumber men, they outvote men in terms of turnout. We won't have official turnout numbers actually until much later in 2021 when the census numbers on turnout come out. But certainly we've seen that turnout be higher among all groups, including women this year, and a shift in terms of women and I should say men. So one of the questions that has been going on this year was, would the gender gap, the difference between men and women, grow even larger? And some polls were suggesting it might be especially large. It was 11 points in 2016. The initial exit polls, which I should be very cautious about, some of them look a little bit off, but they're showing at least a gap that is less than that. What that tells us and what some previous polls prior to the election indicated is that Joe Biden was able to pull both women and men further in his direction versus in comparison Hillary Clinton. So that's an interesting story, but it is still women who were supporting him at the highest rates, and even more so Black women at the highest rates, who are both most likely to turn out at the highest rates and also support Joe Biden.
How do you see? I mean, it is fascinating, the level of turnout, and I always think in a democracy that is a good thing. But let me just toss to you, Kelly, something that Ali said earlier about just how divided our country is. Holly Otterbein was telling us about Georgia, which is very, very close. A number of other states that are very, very close. What does this division tell us about our country, Kelly?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, I mean, you can just literally see it on these maps that we've all been staring at for the last few days, you know, is these pockets of blue and then states of red, you know, in the more rural areas. So there's division within states, even in Pennsylvania. Obviously, that's very true. And I think what it says is that the next president, should it be Joe Biden especially, is going to have a very difficult time in trying to do what he has said he would do, which is bring the country together. And I think to Ali's point, it's hard to know what that looks like, because there's quite a lot of resentment. We know that votes for Donald Trump in the last election and continuing on likely through this election were fueled by things like racial resentment, hostile sexism. There's very real divisions, and divisions that are not just about disagreeing on policy, but actual worldview. And so that's going to be a challenge for the next president. Though if Joe Biden wins, I'm hopeful that he'll at least attempt to do that, whereas Donald Trump has really mined those veins of division to try to capitalize politically.
Ali, let me put something else on the table, just and we could do a whole and probably should do a whole hour on the polls and polling. But a couple of weeks ago, we would see these pretty dramatic differences between the two candidates, and what we saw, especially in these more purple states, just these neck and neck races. How did you see how the polls performed this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the question.
You're the angst in your voice. Minds. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a question that's at the top of a lot of people's minds. You know, I think I have to repeat my initial comments, right? That especially on this question, we do need to be patient because we just don't know how far off the polls are. But to your point, right? They do appear to have, I think, given overconfidence, more confidence to Biden and his supporters than was warranted in some of these states. Now, you know, at the same time, some of it is not terribly surprising, right? It's ultimately, polls are ultimately a good snapshot of a given electorate at a particular point in time, right? And using those polls that were taken, you know, sometime before Election Day, to then essentially guess or, you know, have an educated guess about what's going to happen on Election Day, there's always going to be some error. And, you know, these polls, they're trying to guess who is actually going to turn out to vote. And some people tell them, yes, I'm very likely to turn out to vote. And then, you know, come Election Day, they don't make it to the polls. Other people tell them, no, I'm not going to vote. And they're not included in the estimates of the polls. And then they do turn out to vote, right? And I think Trump.
Only hold on to that thought. Sorry to jump in here. Hold on to that thought,
problem.
Only because we're up on our break here, and we are talking about the polls, election results as they stand, and things are changing even as we talk. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Joe Biden pulled ahead of Donald Trump about an hour ago in Pennsylvania as the votes are still being counted. Talking with Ali Valenzuela from Princeton University, Kelly Dittmar from the Center for American Women and Politics. And joining us now is Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. And Lieutenant Governor Fetterman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Another very close race in Pennsylvania, just like in 2016. Mm-hmm. What does that say about the Commonwealth?
Oh, that it's what I've always said, that Pennsylvania is a deeply purple state. And if you look at the elections exactly a year ago from today for the state Superior Court race, we split that literally down the middle. There were four candidates, two Dems, two Republicans, one of each, and the whole series of four candidates was separated by less than one half of a point. So we're a very divided state in that regard. And I'm not surprised at the least. In fact, I was the only Dem that was warning that, you know, these polls aren't right and we're going to be a lot closer and it's going to be a lot tighter. And, you know, he's intensely popular in Pennsylvania.
Yes. And clearly, I mean, again, as you look at that map, there's lots of red and certainly some blotches of blue as well. We are a divided state, but are we a divisive state? Are we going to be able to live with our differences of opinion?
I sure hope so. The first and foremost, that, you know, when the vice president assumes office, I hope his first order of business is to get us to focus on the coronavirus first and foremost. I mean, you know, we've had the third or fourth day of 100,000 new cases every day. And, you know, the president has made each other the enemy, not the virus the enemy. And we devolved into arguing about masks and social distancing and should we all be packing into crowded bars and dorm rooms for parties? I mean, like the virus doesn't care what we think. It behaves in a very predictable manner, and it's our behavior that needs to change. And I'm hopeful that the vice president can unite us and get this virus under control, because that's the true enemy, is that virus.
Well, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves because the race has not been called, but I understand where you're coming from. Let me get Ali Valenzuela and Kelly Dittmar in on the conversation. And Ali, just going back to you about, and we were talking before the lieutenant governor joined us about just how divided we are as a country. And the question is whether Biden becomes president or Trump remains president, whether we're still going to fight about masks and social distancing and all the things that really do set us apart as a country?
I mean, I think it really depends on the leadership. So you know, I think Democrats and Biden are pretty much on the same page, which is the page that's being advanced by scientists and public health experts. And, you know, I think Trump has very clearly positioned himself against those experts. But, you know, there's a whole class of Republican leaders that has the ability to stand up to Trump. And research shows pretty well that when the parties are kind of on the same page about issues like this, the public tends to follow, right? So in other words, if the Republican leadership can say and stand up to Trump and say, look, that masks are important, let's stop fighting about this, let's get the virus under control, let's get the pandemic under control, I think there is a real possibility that things can turn around here.
How about from your perspective, Kelly?
Yeah, I agree. I think that what we're seeing now and what I think everybody's watching closely is what are Republican leaders doing? What are they saying? I mean, just this morning with the senator from our state, the Republican senator from our state, saying at least publicly there's no evidence of fraud. These sorts of statements are important if we want to maintain both the integrity of the election and the result. And then that, in my view, goes forward to get to a point where folks might be able to come together on the very real and necessary solutions that the lieutenant governor is talking about.
Well, let me go back to you, Lieutenant Governor Fetterman. And the president said yesterday there are allegations of fraud and, frankly, all sorts of charges that are false, unproven. He sent teams of lawyers, members of his family to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia, to fight about some of these vote issues. How much does that hurt sort of where not just the state, but also just the state of our democracy?
Well, at some point, we have to really start asking ourselves how, you know, yelling voter fraud, shrieking about voter fraud without one scintilla of evidence or proof, you know, when does that become yelling fire in a crowded theater? And I think that we're there right now. Just because you have a big microphone doesn't make a lie any more true. And that's what he's trying to advance. And there's no evidence, and there never will be any evidence, because this election was deployed with the most absolute highest standards. Not one episode of voter fraud or voter intimidation or anything meaningful. You know, this is a true result, and it's going to continue to accrue in the favor of the vice president here in Pennsylvania. And that's math. That's not an agenda. That's not fraud. That's just math. And mail-in ballots, as they come in, are going to continue to maintain this bias towards the vice president. And that's what we really need to focus on. You and I, we all would be on your show arguing whether or not any merit to 1 + 1 = 3. We would all know that that's baseless. And if the president started saying 1 + 1 = 3, we wouldn't suddenly all be saying, hey, well, maybe, is he right? Like, no, because it's patently false. And any allegation of voter fraud is also is patently false. So I reject it out of hand. And I wouldn't even dignify that because it's simply just a lie attached to an agenda of chaos to somebody who is not going to like where the direction where we're going.
John Fetterman, an email from Paul says, please touch on late arriving ballots sequestered by the Supreme Court and mailed in military ballots. And he went on to say, Mr. Fetterman mentioned this issue on CNN. And you know, the Supreme Court is, I guess, watching, yeah, waiting to see what happens to these ballots. Go ahead.
It's going to be a big nothing burger because I know that I happen to know that in Philadelphia, that number is tiny. And I'm sure that will translate all across Pennsylvania. And all the ballots that are being canceled, all the ballots that are being counted right now, were all lawfully received before 8 p.m. on election day. So those are outside the scope of any court or legal intervention. So that one, you know, one of the ironies is that the GOP tried to move heaven and earth to get rid of that Supreme Court decision. And at the end of the day, you're going to only be talking about a handful of those kind of ballots. And meanwhile, the vote by mail went beautifully. It's working well. No fraud, no intimidation. We pulled off the biggest election in our Commonwealth's history, and we did it virtually flawlessly, given the scope and scale. And we would have been done days ago, but the Republican leadership in this legislature absolutely refused to give our poll workers even 24 hours to begin pre-canvassing and getting the ballots ready to count. Not even 24 hours. So this is what they started, and they don't like what they're going to have to buy, and it's a result that it won't be favorable to the president. You see it now that the vice president has the lead of around 6,000 votes, and I think you're going to see that continue to climb throughout the day as more and more votes come in.
Well, we will watch and wait. John Fetterman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Ali Valenzuela. He's an assistant professor of politics and affiliated with a program in American Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at Princeton University. Kelly Dittmar, professor of political science at Rutgers University in Camden, director of research at the Center for American Women in Politics. That's at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Both of them joining us from New Jersey, but we are talking about Pennsylvania. We're talking about turnout, where things stand. They think $16, $17 billion spent this election season. Also talking about the mood of the country. And we want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Ali, I'm going to do a really weird segue here, but I do want to talk with you about the Latino vote. And my first question to you, is there such a thing as the Latino vote?
Great question. You know, there's quite a vigorous debate about that question in particular. Though I think on average, yeah, we can think about the Latino community as offering a fairly coherent vote preference. Though, of course, as with any big community, right, there's lots of variation within the group, as I think this election is pointing out very clearly. Right, Cuban Latinos historically have always been very different from, say, Mexican Latinos. That remains true in 2020. There are, you know, very working class Latinos, and there are also very, very wealthy, highly educated Latinos. Right, so there's a full range in this community. But you know, the evidence in this election, the evidence in last election, suggests that somewhere between, you know, 65% and 75%, maybe even a little higher in some places this election cycle, are in favor of the Democrat. You know, and so is it 100%? No. Is it even 90, 95% like blacks are? No, but it's a pretty coherent community overall.
Kelly, let me turn to you. And again, you know, we're still counting ballots, so we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But it's interesting to see women making some inroads into the U.S. Congress, including a number of Republican women. And I want to have you speak to that and help us understand what's going on there.
Yeah, so we're obviously still waiting on a number of races, a little over 20 races where women are candidates in the U.S. Congress. But we've already broken the record for women's representation, though by a small amount. So we currently have 127 women in Congress. We will have at least 132, just to do the quick math for you. That's still less than 25%. So, you know, the message, as it often is after elections for women's representation, is we will celebrate the gains, but also remember that we've got a lot of way to go towards gender parity. The party story is really interesting, and it speaks to the overall dynamics that we're seeing from the presidential level down in terms of the vote. So Republicans overall fared better than expected in both Senate and House races. And that ultimately benefited the record number of Republican women who ran and won nominations for congressional seats this year. So much so that 13 new Republican women have been already elected to the U.S. House. And just to give you context, 13 Republican women currently serve in the U.S. House.
So it's doubling it.
It won't double the number quite yet because two incumbents did not win re-election. They didn't lose. But we're close to doubling, and there's the opportunity to do that. And that would also be a record level of Republican women's representation. And just, again, the only caveat there is they were making up losses, Republican women, that they suffered in 2018. So if you remember, 2018, Republican women dropped from 23 members of the U.S. House to just 13. And again, they still remain a pretty small proportion of the overall Congress. But this is notable because we needed to close this party gap in order to see more gains for women. Last thing is that, though, at the same time, we lost five incumbent Democratic women. So the overall gains are smaller because of that.
It's so interesting to look at some of these down ballot races. Let me read some comments, and then Ali, I'll give you a chance to respond. James says, for the first time in 4 years, I'm cautiously optimistic. It would be poetic justice if Trump was taken down by smart women and African Americans. A question from Veronica: I assume a recount in Pennsylvania would take much less time than the first count. Senator Toomey said there will most probably be one. How long could a decisive outcome be if close states get a recount? And I believe it's as a stands now, there's a recount in Wisconsin. A question from Dave: is the country getting redder? Trump may barely lose, and lots of conservatives like me are only renting Joe Biden for now and will vote Republican next time. That's a very interesting way of putting it. To you, Ali, is the country getting redder, more purple, more? How do you see the color changes?
No, I think this is sort of part of the last gasp of white supremacy and a willingness to tolerate the kind of rhetoric and approaches that Donald Trump, has made popular. I think you know, younger people, pretty much across the board in terms of ethno-racial groups, are changing the nature of our politics. They're changing what issues get attention. You know, climate change and healthcare and education policies, right? These are all things that young people know are what the country needs to address going forward. And frankly, you know, there's a blue wave coming, and it may not have arrived in 2020. But as younger people get older and you know, turn voting age and start to participate, I think we're going to see a bluer country and not a redder one.
Do you see that, Kelly?
Yeah, I think the demographics do speak to that, but I do think it's an important caveat that part of the reason why we're not seeing that affect things sooner in a more significant way, even in this election, is because of the Electoral College. And so looking at the system that we've constructed, obviously Joe Biden has a pretty significant lead at this point. I know we're all following moving numbers, but in the popular vote. But when it comes to how these votes then break because of what is a really, at this point, increasingly disputed system of allocating votes that is, in fact, rooted in the white supremacy that Ali is noting. We do have a problem in terms of the structure in order for these demographic changes to have an effect even sooner. But I certainly think that that is the direction. But in any case like this, you see not only the, I appreciate that last gasp, also a backlash, right? To, as you see a move towards this more progressive politics, a shift in who holds power in this country, some of what we saw even in Donald Trump's initial win was a pushback against that, and a pretty overt and strong one, especially among a lot of Trump supporters.
But Ali, where do the white supremacists go? If Biden becomes president, where do they go?
Hopefully back to the cave that they were in before. To Kelly's point, I want to underline, something that she pointed out here, which I think is super important, right, is that there, the institutions that we have and the institutions that primarily the Republican Party is trying to perpetuate, right, is grounded in, yes, grounded in white supremacy, but it's also grounded in the idea that fewer people should have access to the franchise, that it should be harder to vote. And vote suppression is okay. Vote intimidation is like part of what our politics are about, according to, some of the president's supporters. And, I think as long as, these kinds of institutions, these kinds of efforts continue to be legitimized in our politics, right, that change, that movement towards blue that I was talking about is going to continue to be very slow and perhaps frustratingly so, as Kelly's pointing out.
Well, we are talking about the elections, certainly the race for the White House and some races lower down on the ballot as well, what it all means, where things stand. You probably know by now that just a couple of hours ago, Joe Biden took the lead in Pennsylvania. Of course, Pennsylvania, with its 20 electoral college votes, is critical, frankly, a key to the White House for both of these candidates. And Ali Valenzuela is our guest, and he is assistant professor of politics and at the Program in American Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at Princeton University. Kelly Dittmar, professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, director of research at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of...
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Politics. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I'm just looking over at my TV set here. It looks like Biden has taken the lead in Georgia with about 10,000 votes to go. So obviously another very close race. We've been talking about Pennsylvania, the election as a whole. And again, our guests are Kelly Dittmar and Ali Valenzuela. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jeremy to join our conversation, and Jeremy calling into Radio Times. And go ahead, Jeremy, you are on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
So my question and comment basically has to do with the fact that I'm a millennial voter. I have a lot of peers of mine who consider themselves progressive. And they didn't vote in the general election because Bernie was not on the ticket. And they swear that if Bernie was, that there would be a huge blue wave. So I'm just curious as to whether or not your guests think that parses out in the numbers.
I guess the question, Jeremy, would be that if Bernie were the Democratic nominee, he would beat Trump and beat him handily. Is that what they're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what a lot of younger folks, a lot of my friends are saying.
Let me see what Ali Valenzuela and Kelly Dittmar say. Ali, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think this evidence supports that. So, I think Bernie Sanders certainly is inspiring, and many of his policies are progressive, and they would, I think, fundamentally remake the country. The problem is that, you know, a big chunk of the moderates and certainly Republicans just don't support those policies, right? And evidence, the best evidence shows that if he had been the nominee, sure, young people might have turned out more, progressives might have turned out more, but he also would have lost a bunch of people in the middle who would not have voted for him, who ended up voting for Biden.
Well, and I'm thinking also, Ali, in Florida, the Trump campaign called Joe Biden a socialist, something he's clearly not. But that seemed to work with a lot of, especially Latino voters in that particular state.
Oh yeah, I mean, Biden would have been killed by those attacks. It would have been brutal. And he's never done, you know, a national race like that, going up against, you know, the Republican machine. And so I think it's nice to speculate at this point, right, that he had all this support and he could have mobilized a different coalition. I just don't see it. And I think the best research suggests that, yes, he would have mobilized some people on the left, but he would have lost more in the middle.
Kelly, this has been a longstanding argument within the Democratic Party about just how left, center, or even right the party is in order to win elections. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Ali, and I think a lot of folks, even those who did want to say Bernie would have done better or Elizabeth Warren even would have done better, you know, are looking back and looking at these results and wondering if that was even true. In other words, that actually it would be worse. And I think there's evidence to suggest that's true. One other thing I want to note here is that probably one of the most successful campaigns of Republicans across the country was this argument that the Democrats are extreme socialists. And you see this in races that Democratic incumbents lost. So we lost two women in particular, two women of color in southern Florida, two candidates who were, again, challenging them as being part of this socialist, you know, agenda. And the same is true in an open seat in Indiana, where we thought that a Democrat could possibly take that seat and flip it. Instead, you had a woman who actually, her campaign was very much rooted in her. She is from Eastern Europe. And so her whole campaign was about growing up in a socialist regime and understanding the dangers of that. That message did seem to resonate and affect these House races and potentially the Senate races, allowing the Republicans to keep seats in the Senate and even gain seats in the House, something that, you know, faring better than had been expected. So I think if you have Bernie Sanders, who had, in fact, you know, talks openly about being a democratic socialist, that only fuels that fire even more.
Ali, did you want to add something?
No, I was agreeing.
That was a sound of agreement. Okay. Let me read some more comments. One from Ray. Trump is criticizing mail-in votes, but it was almost impossible to vote by person this year. I waited in line for 2 hours, and most people did. Mail-in was the only option for many people. A comment from David. All parties are giving Trump a pass on his behavior, and I want to see more pushback. There is still decorum that is expected, and Trump is not exhibiting that decorum. Let me take that comment from David, Ali, and put it to you. And it, you know, this is a bit of a thought experiment because we don't know how things are going to end up. But if Trump loses the election and is no longer president, whether the Democrats that have really, the Republicans that have really stood behind him, whether they'll turn their back on him, because we know he's going to fight this until the bitter end. Whether the Republican Party and some of its more stalwart members will turn their back on him, or what do you think might happen there?
Yeah, I mean, so this is right now is a particularly dangerous moment potentially for our country. You know, last night's press conference that Trump did was just it was off the rails. I mean, you all probably know, right? The three major networks cut him off. All the cable stations except CNN and Fox News cut him off. And the New York Times had a headline, right? Trump lies. And the New York Times has been, you know, reticent to label his comments lies. But last night was really bad. And I guess I would take two things from that. One, this is the moment for Republican leaders to stand up to him. and say that we are not going to tolerate that behavior. We are a party in a country of laws and a constitutional order that requires the peaceful handover of power when the votes are counted and you end up losing. But at the same time, it also suggests that putting faith in Trump himself to actually follow those laws and constitutional order may be misplaced, right? He's even if Biden wins, right? He's still the president until January 20th.
Sure.
I'm a bit terrified what he might do if other Republican leaders don't stand up to him. But even if they do, right? I don't have any faith that he will actually behave in a reasonable, measured way. And,
what do you think he'll do? I mean, in your sort of worst case scenario, what do you imagine him doing?
It's hard for me to imagine what he would do. But one remedy that we have still is to impeach him again and actually try to remove him. Oh. Right. Or actually remove him. It's maybe a lost cause politically. But that is a way that we can make sure once the results are known that he doesn't actually burn everything down.
Kelly, do you share some of that same concern that Ali has?
I think in this moment, I think as Ali started this conversation, about sort of taking a deep breath and seeing
patience,
how things
right?
fall. Yeah, I do. I think I'm in that mode of, okay, let's see what happens next. I've actually been surprised that the president hasn't been out doing more of the types of speeches he did last night on a more regular basis. The fact that we didn't see him for more than 24 hours was actually surprising to me. And I think a potentially good sign in the sense that I do worry when we know that when he sort of spins out, he starts to behave in ways that could, again, continue to threaten our institution. So I have no doubt that he will do things like that. But I am sort of holding some faith that some of these leaders would stand against him and he might at some point give up on that. And we might see things that maybe seem, not that they're unimportant, but a bit more less directly affecting Americans, which is pardoning his, peers and friends and things like that, that folks will be frustrated with, but don't necessarily alter significantly everybody's day-to-day well-being. One other thing, though, to note is
sure.
I think we want to remember that even if Trump leaves office after all of this, if we're in January 21st, he has brought in elected officials, folks in the bureaucracy, judges that are all sort of under this Trumpian family, if you will, right, type of politician. So, for example, some of the House members who won this year are very much in line with Donald Trump. And so I'm also curious what that means for them. Do they adjust their politics, or do you continue to have this contingent of elected leaders that are trying to stymie the process and are, in fact, even more sort of enraged and combative when they are not the party in power in terms of the presidency? So I think we have to keep an eye on that as well, and on those politicians and how they too will pose a challenge for not only the next president, but the next Congress and state legislatures.
Let me read a couple more comments, and they are coming in fast and furious, Ali. Laurie says, on media coverage, did New Jersey even have an election? Did you cover it at all? And in response to Laurie's question, yes, we covered it. We have a New Jersey reporter who covered for WHYY. We covered it as part of our regional roundup on Mondays. But it's an interesting question, Ali. I mean, Pennsylvania gets a lot of attention because we are this purple battleground state. But for the reliably red and blue states, kind of ignored by the media, it seems.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. I mean, it goes back to Kelly's point, right, about the Electoral College and the way in which it gives disproportionate power to certain states, right, historically to southern states, to small states, and it creates this perverse political environment where, a number of states are just completely ignored throughout the election cycle. Yeah. And all of our attention, all of the money, all of the mobilization efforts get focused on just a handful of competitive states. So, yeah, it's a problem.
And talking about money, I think it's, $16 billion? An obscene amount of money, Ali, that was spent this year, I think, sort of top to bottom.
Yeah, no, it's pretty bad. Citizens United, continues to reverberate. The notion that there's no appearance of undue influence, I think, is ludicrous. We're seeing the consequences still today.
Number of questions about recounts, and there's one I believe that's going to happen in Wisconsin. And Kelly, hopefully this is part of your area of expertise. In terms of recount, my understanding looking at past recounts is they generally do not change election results. There might be a couple of hundred votes here and there, but we got a lot of very close races that are on the line. Is there anything you want our listeners to think about as if there are some more recounts this season?
Yeah, no, I think this is really important, and I think many of us are becoming more experts on these things as we move forward. But certainly, on recounts, the historical evidence would show, especially when we're talking about statewide recounts, that not that a result can't change, but usually you're talking about hundreds, if that, of votes that might change based on the recount. And that's a high estimate. Oftentimes, it can be as low as 10, 20, 30 votes. So unless the margin is that small, you wouldn't expect the recount to change that result. And add to this that every state has their own rules and policies about recounts. So we also have to be very clear about that. For example, I think in Pennsylvania, there's an automatic recount if the difference is 0.5%. Looks like that's not going to potentially be the case. We'll see. And if it's not an automatic recount and there's a requested recount, the campaign has to pay unless there's evidence of fraud found in that recount, again, in most states. So there's all sorts of complications. I don't think most people think that this is a direction that will actually lead to success for Donald Trump, as many people also doubt the court strategy.
Oh, we are almost out of time, and Ali, I'm putting a question to you, and I feel a little Pollyanna saying this, but nonetheless, and I'm kind of, I think it's pretty obvious, kind of wonky when it comes to politics and election politics, but I have to say, it's the turnout being one, if you paid attention, you got to see got a real civics lesson on how voting works when it works well. In many ways, it's a very handmade process. People handing over pieces of paper. You can watch the vote count at the convention center in Philadelphia. It's on a public access television. So it's there for us to observe. And should we feel good about it, inspired by it even?
I do think
that's
inspiration.
You. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do think there's a bit of inspiration to be taken here, right? In the midst of the worst public health crisis in 100 years, threats to I think public safety, efforts to disenfranchise voters by removing drop boxes, right? Mm-hmm. Eliminating access to the franchise. The fact that we're going to see, in all likelihood, right, some of the highest turnout in, I don't even know how long. I don't know what the last time we've had this high of turnout. I'm sure you have that date written down somewhere. But despite all of these obstacles, right, so many hundreds of millions of people cast a ballot in this election, I think is fantastic. And we should be not complacent, right, and leave it here, but continue the activism, continue getting people registered, involved in politics, and getting them to recognize that what happens in politics affects, all of our lives, all of our daily lives. And, I'm calling you here stuck at home, right, I've been for the last 6-7 months, whatever it is. And so the things that our leaders do really do affect us on a daily basis.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ali Valenzuela, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Politics, affiliated with a program on American Studies and the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics. That's at Princeton University. Kelly Dittmar, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus, Director of Research at the Center for American Women in Politics, and that's at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. We also heard from Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, and we began our conversation with Holly Otterbein, reporter for Politico. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And, of course, you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.